Raw Data is produced by Worldview Stanford, which creates interdisciplinary learning experiences for curious leaders. To learn more about Worldview, visit worldview.stanford.edu.
This podcast is also supported by the Stanford Cyber Initiative, which aims to produce research and inform debates about safely integrating cyber technologies into society. Learn more about the Cyber Initiative at cyber.stanford.edu.
From Stanford, this is Raw Data. I'm Mike Osborne.
And I'm Leslie Chang. Today's show, the Hippocratic Algorithm. Big data is revolutionizing health and medicine. New data sets from individuals and across populations are offering researchers the chance to study the human body like never before. What they're learning might completely transform medical care as we know it.
Of course, a lot of the excitement stems from genomics. The genome is the blueprint for your body, and among other things, it contains information about the diseases you might be at risk for.
Today, you can sequence your genome for around $1,000. 10 years ago, that price point would have been unimaginable.
But the big data of health and medicine goes far beyond your DNA. Now scientists can also study your RNA, proteins, and microbiomes in extreme detail.
On top of that, wearable technologies like Fitbits and Jawbones have hit the consumer market in a big way. These devices have given rise to the quantified self movement, offering us high-resolution information about our physical activity, sleep patterns, heart rate, and much more.
So what's the limit of all this? Just how much can one person quantify their own body? And what might that information mean for the rest of us?
Mike Snyder is a genetics researcher at Stanford, and in a nutshell, that is exactly what he set out to discover.
My lab is a little unusual in that we study people in incredible detail. So really, the goal of our work is to understand how, with a DNA sequence and with various environmental exposures, you can predict someone's health.
Snyder is taking the quantified self to the extreme. And he started with the most convenient test subject he could find, himself.
A few years ago, he started collecting as much data as he possibly could about his own body. Snyder got his genome sequenced, and then he and his colleagues began monitoring all kinds of different variables.
We want to not only understand how your DNA can be used to help manage your health, it's how collecting all kinds of information can help manage your health. It's really big data to the max, if you will, where we collect blood and make measurements of all of my molecules, my RNA, my proteins, my metabolites. We literally make billions of measurements on me every time we sample me.
The list of data points is exhaustive.
We are measuring heart rate, skin temperature, stress, which is really skin conductance. We measure sleep. We measure activity, so all the steps people take, they're biking, they're running. And we've been doing that on me for some time. We're studying my microbiome as well. We study 5 different microbiomes. We do my stool, urine, nasal, tongue, and skin. So again, we're trying to measure all possible parameters to see which parameters associate with which biochemical outcomes, which in turn associates with your health. That's really the goal. It's to understand the equation.
When Snyder first started collecting all this information, for the most part, everything he found in his genome matched up with what he knew from his family history.
But one of the surprises was increased risk for type 2 diabetes, which hit me as a surprise because I was not aware of that from my family history.
Now, Snyder would not strike you as someone who might have type 2 diabetes.
He's Caucasian, he's not overweight, and he looks athletic and fit.
In terms of the traditional demographic categories, most doctors would assume he's at low risk.
And we had been measuring my sugar levels because we're making these literally billions of measurements, and they were running along just fine. But ironically, when I went in to get a more fancier glucose test, I discovered, in fact, my glucose was elevated on that particular day. And we repeated it as high again, and it went up even higher to the point where I was classified as diabetic. So my genome actually predicted as risk for a disease, which I got. And it was a big deal because it's the first time anyone's been able to do that, that from your DNA sequence, you could see what you're at risk for and then actually got the disease.
Snyder found out about his diabetes early, and he started taking steps to manage it. He changed his diet and increased his exercise.
I think that's the power of having this information. You're on the lookout for it. You catch things early. And this is why medicine's going to change. We're going to shift medicine. And that's really the whole goal of this project. It's really to completely transform medicine. We want to change it from what we do now, which is treating people once they get symptoms, once they get unhealthy, to shifting it to preventing and minimally early diagnosis.
Now, Snyder doesn't believe that the future of healthcare will involve all of us gathering this incredible level of detail on ourselves. But he does think that some toned-down version of personal health monitoring should become standard in the future.
Imagine being able to predict your diseases before they ever show up. This type of monitoring at the individual level can be extremely helpful for common health problems. The quantified self movement is not just a fad. Doctors genuinely believe that wearable devices may help save lives.
Dr. Ewan Ashley is a cardiologist and professor of genetics at Stanford, and he's especially excited about the potential of using wearable technologies to get ahead of heart problems.
And our sense is that the wearable-type technologies, monitoring people while they're still healthy, could actually help us pick up disease much earlier, and even better than that, might be able to pick up an unhealthy lifestyle so that they never get disease in the first place.
Most of us assume that the big risk factors for heart disease are things like smoking, diabetes, and diet.
But it turns out that wearables actually track the most important factor.
But actually, our single biggest risk factor for heart disease is inactivity. And so being able to move someone from being inactive and sedentary to active is actually the most potent drug that we have. I mean, as we calculated recently, another scientist had alerted us to this way of thinking, which is that for every minute of exercise, you gain 5 minutes of life. So the idea that you don't have time to exercise doesn't make sense anymore.
Wearables can also track your heartbeat. So if you have abnormal heart rhythms, a doctor would be able to anticipate whether you're at increased risk for cardiovascular problems.
One of the major risk factors for stroke is the presence of atrial fibrillation. But many people are out there wandering around who don't know that they have it. Yet, we actually have a great treatment. If we knew which people in the population were having atrial fibrillation, we can use a blood thinner and vastly reduce their risk of stroke, being almost back down to normal. And so you can imagine now a situation where if everybody was wearing a watch that was able to tell whether they were in normal rhythm or in abnormal rhythm, then it could beep when they go into atrial fibrillation, and they could go and see their doctor and decide if they need one of these blood thinners and potentially prevent a stroke.
Think about that for a second. With a device that costs around $100, you can now gather continuous data on the most important risk factor for cardiovascular disease.
All we'd need is a system to monitor that data and look for early warning signs. This intervention has the potential to save countless lives. Cardiovascular disease, which includes heart disease and stroke, is the leading cause of death in the U.S., killing around 1.5 million people every year.
The second leading cause of death in the U.S. is cancer. And here again, researchers are making huge strides as a result of big data. In fact, it's fundamentally changing our whole framework for categorizing and understanding cancer.
Sylvia Plavridis is a researcher in the Department of Radiology at Stanford, and she is on the front lines of that paradigm shift. Plavridis has a unique combination of experience in both data analytics and cancer biology.
I study computational modeling in cancer. I apply computational models to understand cancer biology. I also apply computational models to understand how cancer control interventions, like screening and treatment, really impact cancer trends at the population level, you know, cancer incidence, cancer mortality rates.
When it comes to cancer, there are a lot of new data sets to work with and increasingly sophisticated tools for analyzing them.
So in the world of cancer, we now profile individual tumors with many different technologies. So we have whole genome, we have information at the DNA, RNA level, we have information about a whole bunch of molecular activity. So the amount of data is really deep. So we have data now in an individual patient. So we have the pathology, we have the medical imaging data, we have the treatments that they've gotten, We have their outcomes in terms of progression-free survival. If they recur, what type of cancer they recur with, how did it compare to the initial cancer? If they have metastatic occurrences, where those metastases occur. So this is longitudinal data on an individual that is captured in de-identified ways, but for research purposes, so we could look across many different people with this very rich data that we've never had before.
By combining this rich array of data sets, the idea is that we can better understand the origins as well as the progression of different types of cancer. This offers a whole new approach.
Cancer used to be diagnosed by what tissue it was in, whether it had invaded other tissues, and what cell types were involved. Now, we're moving towards an understanding of cancer that goes far beyond location in the body.
We can now take into account the unique genetic mutation of a particular tumor, how it progresses, as well as the genome and individual biology of the patient.
And when you start to build up these detailed databases that include treatment strategies and disease outcomes, you're suddenly looking at the potential for a revolution in cancer research, prevention, and therapy.
I think more in the short term, like 5 to maybe 10 years from now, I really do believe in personalized medicine, that we will be at a point where we will be individualizing treatments for a particular patient. We understand now that everybody's tumor is really different and that variation that's specific to the patient is information that's necessary to drive the best response in that individual patient.
Big data provides a whole new architecture for how we organize different kinds of patients. It's based on the genes we're born with, as well as the multitude of experiences that shape our health.
Here again is Ewan Ashley.
We really are at the frontier of a transformative time in medicine. I think that our challenge really is to know what to do with the data and to do it responsibly. But I think there is, first of all, there's no question that the data is here and it's getting cheaper all the time. And billions and even trillions of data points will be available on individuals. And what we have to do is work out how to use it responsibly and use it to help people, prevent them getting disease, as well as help them when they have disease, get the best therapy.
But this raises an issue. If there's so much raw data out there about us, how is this information going to make its way into the doctor's office? This question came up in our conversation with Mike Snyder.
I don't think the medical profession is really equipped for this, because at the end of the day, this is throwing a lot of information out there that they're not really trained to handle. And it's a very different way that medicine's currently practiced, where the doctor is the know-all and tell-all to the patient. There is consultations, it's true. But this will shift things pretty dramatically because there's no way they can know all of the relevant information here.
Used to having doctors who can hold a lot of specialized knowledge in their heads. But as Mike Snyder points out, we're heading into a world where there will be so much data on individual patients that our current system may not be equipped to handle it.
If computers and algorithms become so powerful that they can diagnose us and make critical decisions about treatment strategies, what exactly is the role of the human doctor in this scenario?
Big data might totally transform the doctor-patient relationship. And it raises big questions for how best to train the next generation of doctors and medical care professionals.
One person who's been thinking about all this is Dr. Abraham Verghese. He's been leading a community of physicians who are advocating for something that seems almost antiquated in today's era of advanced medical technology.
This community of physicians wants to revive the art of bedside medicine. A few years ago, Dr. Verghese delivered an influential TED Talk about the importance of the physical exam.
I joke, but I only half joke, that if you come to one of our hospitals missing a limb, no one will believe you till they get a CAT scan, MRI, or orthopedic consult. I am not a Luddite. I teach at Stanford. I'm a physician practicing with cutting-edge technology. But I'd like to make the case to you in the next 17 minutes that when we shortcut the physical exam, when we lean towards ordering tests instead of talking to and examining the patient, we not only overlook simple diagnoses that can be diagnosed at a treatable early stage, but we're losing much more than that. We're losing a ritual. We're losing a ritual that I believe is transformative, transcendent, and is at the heart of the patient-physician relationship.
Dr. Verghese now heads the Stanford Medicine 25 Initiative. It's an effort to emphasize the importance of the physical exam for doctors in training.
Over the past several weeks, Leslie and I have been talking to Dr. Verghese and his team about the future of the doctor-patient relationship.
One point they've made to us is that there's a growing conversation in the medical community about errors that arise from oversights in the physical exam.
A few weeks ago, this group hosted a symposium in order to bring together like-minded physicians who are also concerned that bedside medicine is not being emphasized in medical training.
The Stanford 25 team invited Mike and me to interview some of the people attending their symposium.
We jumped at the opportunity. We were extremely curious to see what this group of physicians had to say about how best to train doctors for the era of big data.
We ended up talking to physicians from all around the world. One doctor we talked to was Bilal Ahmed.
I'm a professor of medicine at the University of Rochester in upstate New York. So every Friday, I do what's called Holmes rounds from the Sherlock Holmes rounds. So basically, these are detective rounds. And the whole emphasis is on looking at the patient and describing what they see. And you wouldn't believe how people cannot even describe what's in front of them.
When we asked him for an example, Dr. Ahmed went on to tell us this story about an elephant trainer for the Ringling Brothers Circus.
They were driving in from Connecticut to Rochester, and in the middle of this, he had the most severe headache of his life. And the triage nurse in the emergency, she sees the patient, and her immediate closure is that the patient has an intracranial hemorrhage.
The nurse enters intracranial hemorrhage into the patient's electronic medical record.
And Dr. Ahmed told us that once something's entered into the computer system, it's hard to take it back. From here on, every person on the medical team who sees the patient will assume the record is accurate.
I call it the baton phenomena. So you pass on the baton to other people. So the next person who comes, he or she sees, intracranial hemorrhage. So what do you do for that? You do an MRI scan. So the patient gets wheeled into the MRI scanner. They do the MRI scan. And the patient comes out and they said, oh my God, so there's a ventricle in the brain, it's called the lateral ventricle, it's an empty space full of fluid, it's huge on one side. And they said, oh, so this is what's causing this guy's pain. From then on, that patient is living in a digital world of that image and that nurse's thought about that patient. The patient, Dr. Verghese often states, becomes an eye patient. No one knows this patient because we have the answer now, we don't need to see the patient.
The medical team calls a neurosurgeon who decides, based on the MRI scan, that the patient is going to need a dramatic medical procedure where they're going to drill into his skull.
And by this time, this guy's really kind of upset at everything. His head is hurting, and he's got the blanket on his head, his girlfriend. Yeah, he's very upset because, here his elephants are going crazy at him downtown because they really miss him. So there was the pandemonium on the main street when they marched the elephants. it was actually in the news.
Cascading effects.
It's been in the news because one of the elephants escaped, and he wasn't there. So anyways, so we convince him to put the blanket down. And he grudgingly puts the blanket down, and he's got a herpes zoster of his face where the pain is originating from, of this upper part of his face, and which was causing his symptoms.
Herpes zoster is more commonly known as shingles, and the main symptom is a painful rash.
The thing he had in his head was congenital. He was born with that. Had nothing to do with the symptoms. But the fact was, nobody... I said, did anybody see you? Did they see this thing? He said, well, I've been telling him this, and they say, you have pain, so you're rubbing your head, so it's okay, don't forget about it. So nobody had actually seen this patient. They'd made the assumptions in a digital world. They had come to conclusions. They were going to crack open his head. They were going to put the stent in. It was going to cost $100,000, and he may have surgical complications. Who knows? He could have died. All because nobody... So this is just a story that how just a simple maneuver of going to the bedside and seeing the patient and talking to them can change the whole picture.
Another person we talked to was Dr. Brian Garibaldi. He told us about a situation in the ICU where the doctors were so engrossed in their computers that they forgot to keep an eye on the patient.
I was rounding in the intensive care unit, and it was one of these, you know, it was just when the computers on wheels, or cows as some people call them, were becoming really, really popular in the ICU, and we had the entire resident team, everyone had their own computer in a semicircle around the door to the room, and I was the only one who didn't have a computer. And as the resident was presenting from their note, and they had to keep pausing because the computer froze, and I watched the patient's heart rate start to drop, and I watched their blood pressure start to drop, and I watched them start to become less responsive in the bed. And in the middle of this wonderful presentation that the computer allowed the resident to do, I walked into the room, pulled the code button, and started CPR. And no one else had realized that. No one had picked up on any of those things happening 5 feet from us, because they were glued to their computer screen.
Another doctor told us about a patient who contracted gangrene of the foot because of a condition in his stomach. It went unnoticed for 3 months, but this condition should have been revealed by a physical exam.
And another doctor told us about a woman with dementia who everyone thought had a urinary tract infection. Patients with dementia often feel pain and discomfort differently, and when they finally did a thorough physical exam, it turned out her pain was coming from a broken leg.
With all our advanced medical technology, the decidedly non-digital physical exam still holds incredible value.
But as Bilal points out, these stories about the importance of bedside medicine are not easily captured by data.
There is no data point to tell you how the mistakes happen, how the perceptions go wrong, how there's poor care. That is a very nebulous thing. That is more like art than science. So, you know, but data doesn't capture art.
This community of physicians is making a compelling argument that the physical exam can reduce medical errors and save costs by avoiding unnecessary tests.
But there's another layer to the bedside medicine message. The physical exam also builds trust and compassion between a doctor and a patient.
As patients, our medical outcome is important, but it's not the only thing that matters. When we're at the doctor's office, we're there because we need help. We're vulnerable.
Building trust is a critical part of what doctors do. But as physicians have had to incorporate more technology and digital tools into their work, this sometimes falls by the wayside.
The patient's perception of disease and care is totally different to my perception of disease and care. So I would be very happy if I diagnose a very complicated disease in a patient by using all these tests. I would think I've done a very good job, and maybe I've saved a patient's life. But if I have not done those rituals, the patient's perception is totally different. Our patients expect us as providers, as caregivers, to do certain things. And if you kind of skip those things, there is this feeling of that there is something missing in this interaction.
For a lot of patients, what's missing is a sense of human connection and empathy, something a computer can't provide, but that we expect from our doctors.
So what Abraham is saying all the time, people question that. Say, how can he say that human touch actually improves outcome? Where's the data? There is no data. So, you know, but I believe it does. I believe it forms a connection. It forms trust. The patient believes in you. They will follow what you're trying to do. They will come out with information which they never divulge to anybody else.
One of the trappings of big data is that we often feel like we have all the information. But as we learned at the symposium, that's not necessarily true. Doctors can learn critical information from their patients when they build a trusted relationship. Information that might not be captured in the genome, blood tests, or wearable devices.
Just to be clear, we don't want to give the false impression that the bedside medicine community is anti-data or anti-technology. Everyone we talk to believes that big data can empower both the doctor and the patient.
The challenge is in how best to use that data and how to prepare the next generation of doctors.
Here again is Ewan Ashley.
That's going to be one of our major challenges for the next decade of medicine. And it just is such transformative change. I mean, the amount of data that's available at the fingertips of physicians and other medical providers is just unprecedented. And so getting it to them in a way that's ingestible and that doesn't detract from the interaction with the patient is going to be our major challenge. Some of my colleagues in the Valley like to speculate that we don't need doctors anymore because we have algorithms. I mean, clearly, I'm not putting myself out of business. I don't believe that. I'm sure Abraham doesn't believe that, because so much a part of the interaction with the medical system has to be human.
Yeah.
And there's always going to be things that the algorithm cannot detect.
But that's kind of the big question. What medical decisions do we feel comfortable handing over to algorithms, and what parts of medical care are fundamentally human?
And even more than that, who is going to be ultimately responsible for all this data about our bodies and our health? Whose job will it be to make the best use of our most important information?
Raw Data is produced by me, Mike Osborne, and Leslie Chang. Our theme song is by Nick Carlozzi. We'd like to thank Bree Linkenhoker for editing help this week.
We also want to send a special thanks to Abraham Verghese, Sonu Thurdani, and Jeff Chi for their help and generosity in inviting us to the Bedside Medicine Symposium.
You can learn more about their work by checking out the Stanford Medicine 25 Initiative online. Their website is stanfordmedicine25.stanford.edu.
We also want to thank Sharat Israni and Janet Kolesnikoff. To learn more about big data and biomedicine research happening at Stanford, check out Stanford's Biomedical Data Science Initiative.
You can also learn more about Mike Snyder's research by going to snyderlab.stanford.edu. That's spelled S-N-Y-D-E-R.
We are a production of Worldview Stanford, and you can find us on the web at worldview.stanford.edu. We're on Twitter at Raw Data Podcast.
Thanks for listening.
From PRX.